It was actually really funny. Yesterday, I put it in the newsletter that I sometimes have a problem with food, that like when I eat, but more importantly, when I brush my teeth. Heather always says, wait till you brush your teeth and then put your clothes on, because it's almost like the shirt cries out, like, feed me, or brush my teeth. And it's like this, and this is no joke. Yesterday, we're sitting, Heather made me a chicken quesadilla. And I put some salsa and sour cream on it. Oh, so good. So, you know, you do the little, you cut the thing, and I got this slice, and I put a little bit of extra salsa and sour cream on it, and so I pull it up, and I eat it, and it's no joke. The first bite, I bite in, and as I'm pulling away, I could see it, no, and it hit, and I froze, and I'm like, maybe Heather didn't see it, and I kind of look over, and she's just shaking her head. And then I did it a second time. Like, so that starts in the wash. I am, when it comes to being sloppy and messy, I am one of those people. We're going to be talking, clearly, yeah, obviously I didn't have a fight with the chocolate waxy donut. But this is going to be talking a little bit about what we experience in our lives when it comes not just for mess, the physical messes we make, but when our lives are a spiritual mess. And that is what the prophecy, what the vision that Zechariah is going to have. I'm telling you, Zechariah might now be my new favorite Old Testament book of the Bible. I mean, the stuff that is being said in here has so much encouragement. I know we've done Haggai, and he had some encouragement, but he had also a lot of warnings. I don't know, maybe Zechariah is going to get weird at the end, but so far I'm absolutely loving what is being said here. And as they are rebuilding, remember that there's kind of three realms that the people lived in. They lived under the prophetic realm, so they had prophets, people that would speak to them. This is what God says. They also lived under a priestly realm, so they'd have a high priest. And then they also operated under the governmental realm. And so they would have some sort of leader. And so that's where we find ourselves. I mentioned it last week, but it's good to remember. We have the prophet, and there were several prophets, if you remember. Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi were all in this post-exilic time. And then we have the high priest, whose name is Joshua. Clearly not the Joshua that fought the Battle of Jericho, because that's like a long time ago, and he's already long dead. But there's a new Joshua, and he is the high priest. And then you have the leaders at the time. Zerubbabel was part of that. Then it was also under Ezra, also under Nehemiah. And so these people, as they come back, one of the questions that they're wrestling with is, what are they going to especially do about the priestly realm? Prior to that, the priests were all corrupt. As they were leading up into that exile, some of the stuff that the priests were doing were absolutely horrible. Now, they've always had a struggle with this. Would we say the same thing about us in today's culture? Are there priests and pastors who are corrupt, right? Right? Pastors that are only in it for the money, right? Only in it for the fame? Only in it for the power? Yeah, there are corrupt pastors. There are corrupt priests. But this one, The reason why it got really difficult was it became a lot more of them, and it truly then started negatively affecting the people of God, because they would have their corruption, and then they would end up telling others that's how you should live your life. And that's the reason why, again, the Word of God is so important, that you don't just listen to what I say. You don't just listen to what other pastors say on YouTube or on their channels, but you're always comparing everything back to the Word of God. So as these priests who had gotten taken away and they're coming back now, we got Joshua, the question is, what is the priesthood going to be like? How are they going to live? And Zechariah gives this incredible, incredible vision. Chapter 3 of Zechariah. Then he showed me Joshua, the high priest, standing before the angel of the Lord, and Satan standing at his right side to accuse him. The Lord said to Satan, "The Lord rebuke you, Satan. The Lord who has chosen Jerusalem rebuke you? Is not this man a burning stick snatched from the fire?" So we get introduced. Now, there's a lot of concern or questioning of if this is like the Satan, or if it is just someone who represents that because they are accusatory. Because remember, the word Satan just means the accuser. So this could be your own conscience at times. You're sitting around. You've decided that you're going to start living your life more for God. You've done all that you can to see how you could reshape and reform your life, dedicating it to God. And then out of nowhere, these voices start coming into your head. And they're usually one of two extremes. You either got one extreme that says, "Yeah, you're not that good. You've got a lot of sin. You've got a lot of stain. I don't think God can use you. You should really, right? You know, compare yourself to another. See how good they are? See how bad you are? You should really rethink this ministry thing." Or you get then the opposite extreme, which is, "Oh, your sin? That's okay. Yeah. No. You don't need to change it. You don't need to do anything about it. Remember, oh, God is a God of grace. Just keep sinning. In fact, actually, you will then be able to identify more with your people. And as you do that, you will become a better pastor, a better priest." That's what goes through my head a lot. And I bet if I talked to a lot of pastors, they'd say the same thing. But I think you also feel it too, don't you? Sometimes maybe you're about to go on a new venture. Maybe you're about to head out on a mission trip, or maybe you're about to start a nonprofit that's focused on some sort of mercy ministry, and you're thinking to yourself, "Yeah, I really want to now do something more for God." Or maybe it's even smaller. Maybe it's like, "You know what? I need to start a new Bible reading plan." Or, "You know what? I'm going to start putting my phone away and start doing more in terms of devotional or Bible reading, or just even some simple prayer. And you know what? I'm going to set an alarm on my phone," and small, simple things. And then all of a sudden, the voices start happening. Are you really going to accomplish anything? And really, you're asking God to bless this, but I mean, look at your life. It's a total disaster. Like, God's not going to look at you and go, "Oh, I like this guy." It can also come from other people too, right? Especially childhood friends, right? Because they know you the best. I always find it funny when I get together with my childhood friends, because they look at me and they don't see a pastor. They see Mark. Same thing with my home congregation. That's just young punk Mark, and he's a pastor now. He was an idiot. Like, he probably still is an idiot. Why are we going to listen to him? And I remember going back and preaching, and that was exactly what happened. I did this great stirring sermon. I remember it was all about running the race that was marked out for us. And I think I'm really getting them with, like, you know, some of you are not even running, or some of you are running in circles and you're not focused on God. But then I talked about the grace that God gives, and that Christ ran the race. And man, it was one of the most inspiring sermons I thought I'd ever preached. And I just had people, "Oh, Mark, so good to see you. Welcome back. Glad you are here." And I'm like, "Oh, nothing about my really awesome sermon? Oh, that was a really awesome sermon. And no, weren't you the kid that drove your car on the lawn and broke all the sprinkler systems?" That's a true story. I got dared by some other youth in youth group to do that. And so it's tough, because others might say, "You're just not good enough." Or maybe it's past relationships. Those are always good for stuff, right? Like exes that go, "Yeah, no, you're an idiot, and that's why we stopped seeing each other, and you think you're going to do something better now? You are a mess." So we don't know if this is the Satan. It possibly could be. I wouldn't be surprised, because Satan does seem to show up at really crucial junctions, and this is a crucial junction for the people of God as they're redoing some stuff. And so Joshua is the high priest. Could you imagine being the head guy spiritually of a people that had been in exile for 70 years, being punished for their complete and utter lack of following after God and you're coming back into the land for the very first time, I'd be a little nervous. Am I worthy enough to lead? And here we already have this story, and this, and God is saying, "Look, he's a firebrand." And I know that's a weird thing for us, but it's the burning stick that's being pulled out of the fire, and he's just kind of smoldering. And of course, if you have a piece of wood that's been in there and it's been burned for a while, what is it? It's completely black. Falls apart a lot, right? If you tried to take it and do something with it, it's just going to crumble into a bunch of these ashes and coals. And so he's saying that, yes, Joshua doesn't have everything together, and he kind of crumbles every time something happens, and he's really, really dirty, but he's mine. I snatched him from the fire. He is valuable to me. How important to hear it as a pastor, because then it's a reminder for me as well. Me, a burning stick snatched from the fire. I got dirty clothes too. It's nasty and it's gross sometimes, but God makes a proclamation, you are mine. One of the places that Heather and I went and visited on our Germany trip was to a place called Eisenach. And in Eisenach, there's this really cool castle, and it's called the Wartburg Castle. And it's a fantastic place in Lutheran heritage, because this was where Luther, being brash and impulsive, don't you hate pastors like that? I mean, they're just annoying. And brash and impulsive, and he's been invited to go to this conference. The conferences were called diets. And so he was getting ready to go, but there was a price on his head, dead or alive. So you now had the freedom to kill the person, and you would face no backlash. And so he was going to this, and so his friend Frederick the Wise decided to kidnap him in this really cool thing and then put him up in the Wartburg Castle. And while he was at Wartburg Castle, he translated the New Testament. I think it was like 30 days from the original German. And it took him a little bit longer to do the Hebrew Old Testament, but he translated into the vernacular of the people. And in one of the rooms, we actually got to see the room where he was in. And it was funny because there's these legends that have come up about that, and one of them is the legend of the inkwell, where Luther is trying to work. I mean, could you imagine? You are Luther, and you're trying to fight the church and do reforms and trying to get people back to the Word of God, and people are hunting you and wanting to kill you. And Luther said that he had a problem with his own sins. And again, these are legends. They're probably not true, but they're very relatable. And one of those legends was when he was sitting there and he could hear Satan telling him, God's not going to use you. You're not good enough. You've sinned way too much. And the story goes, again, probably not true, but I still like it. Luther said to Satan, you need to try the list of sins that you have against me, because you missed some. I'm way worse than you think. And so Satan came back and, well, okay, yeah, you know what? You are worse. You're this, you're this, you're this, you're this. And Luther's like, well, no, there's still some things you missed. And he's like, yeah, okay, there's this and there's this. And finally, Luther said, yeah, but you forgot one thing. I'm forgiven. And legend has it, he grabbed an inkwell, you know, back in the days when you would dip your pen, and he took the inkwell and he chucked it against the wall. And he said, and he did write this later, that he fought Satan with an inkwell. Now, what most people now believe is that he didn't fight him with like a physical, you know, like throwing something against the wall, but he did it by doing the translation of the Bible. But that legend happened so much that as people came to this castle, Wartburg Castle, they would go in and they'd scrape off the parts of where the ink was. And then the guards were like, if that gets completely scraped, we're going to lose all our business. So they would repaint the wall with more ink, and then more people would come. And I took pictures of it where, yeah, you could see like this one area. It's been scraped and scraped and scraped, and there's no ink there anymore. But do you ever feel that way? Like when you feel like you're trying to do something, and all you could think about is all your past failures. That's Satan. That's the accuser trying to tell you you are no good. And God has something different to say. Yes, you're a little crumbly, you got some stain on you, but you're mine. I snatched you from the fire. And there's no weird, I love it because sometimes you get around some people and they've got, you know, you got to scream real loud at Satan, right? Because it's what you got to do. And you know, if we're going to do an exorcism, man, we're going to scream and yell and we're going to sweat and it's going to be crazy. And in this, what is it that God does? I rebuke you. That's it. Same thing happened in the book of Jude, right? The Satan and they're fighting over the body of Moses with Michael the Archangel. Don't ask me why. It's a strange story. And he didn't, you know, go into some weird incantation saying, oh, this. All he did was say, I rebuke you. That's the power that we have. It's not because of our power, but because of God's power that is behind that. And so no matter what Satan comes against you with, you've got to respond with, but I am God's. Now, I belong to God. Now, the problem is what we typically do is something else. So, yeah, Jim's excited because he knew this was going to happen because I told him about it. But, you know, what do we do whenever we get, like, some stains on our clothes, right? We just do a little dress-up, right? Because we don't want people to know all about this. So, hey, by the way, remember May the 4th and I couldn't find my Millennium Falcon tie? My wife found it because she's amazing. So, yes. So what do? We got some stains on us. And I've done this before where you get a stain on a shirt and what do? You're like, I'll just put a little tie on and that'll be great. And I'll just cover up some of that stain. And look at that. We got to cover up more of the stain. So we just take a jacket and we put it on and we're like, look at that. Look how pretty clean we are. If I do something like, how's that? Is that looking pretty good? Yeah. We just kind of cover it up. We say we'll cover it up with our good deeds, right? Because, okay, I've done some bad stuff, but maybe I can, like, do some good stuff. Like, I'm going to help an orphanage, or I'm going to volunteer at a soup kitchen, or I'm going to donate money to a nonprofit. And we think to ourselves, that's just going to cover up our stain. The problem is, we still have the stain. It's still there. And so this is going to be the dilemma now because God's even going to start talking about the clothes that Joshua's wearing. Look at what he says. Just fascinating. I love this imagery. Verse 3, now Joshua was dressed in filthy clothes as he stood before the angel. I forgot to say this part. Like, filthy clothes. I'll tell you this. It's not this. This is dirty. This is chocolate waxy donuts. I sacrificed one for my imagery here today. This is not the filth. The word that is used here is something way more vile and disgusting. Heather and I, when I was fourth year seminarian, she was working for the National Youth Gathering. As assistant registrar, somehow or another, it got around to the seminary community that I play the guitar. Now, when I say I play the guitar, that means I can do camp songs, right? Like, give me oil in my lamp, keep me burning, burning, burning. Yeah, and it only takes a spark to get the fire going, right? Those are the types of things, like, you know, this stuff here, like, A flat. How do I play in the key of A flat? That doesn't make any sense to me. So Heather and I, when we would do youth events, sometimes you just pull out the camp songs. They're so much fun. So somehow or another, that got around the seminary, and then we got contacted by the seminary president's wife. Her name was Ruth Ann Johnson. This wonderful lady, husband was the president of the seminary, John Johnson. And he said, she said, hey, I hear you guys do some like fun camp songs. And we're like, yeah, we do. She's like, we are having a bunch of like big donors and a big party. But what we're doing is it's going to be like a hoedown. We're going to have, you know, everyone's dressing in flannels and overalls. And we're going to have hay all over the place. And it'll be great. Do you guys have outfits like that? We're like, yeah. And they're like, she said, can you like come and do this? We're like, we can pull this off. Like, we have a lot of fun. We only had one problem, and that was we had Mark Thomas, and he was a baby. He was just a little guy. So we got there, and we're like, well, maybe we just, like, he could just sit there. Like, just put him in the little seat, and he'll be good. And so we're over there, and Ruth Ann comes over to us and says, okay, you guys are, you know, up next. And we're like, okay, we're just getting Mark Thomas situated. She goes, here, give me the baby. Give me the baby. She's like, I raise boys. Come on, give me the baby. Give me the baby. I love babies. So grabs the baby, and she's holding the baby. It's great. So Heather and I go up, and, you know, we're getting oil in our lamp, and, you know, it's a lot of fun. And finally, we're done with it. And so I go down. I put my guitar, and Heather goes to Ruth Ann, and Ruth Ann hands Mark Thomas back, and she is literally covered in fecal matter. This is a true story. And Heather and I gasp. He pooped on the seminary president's wife. Not just pooped. It was a runny kind. I think, and I don't know if he vomited or not, but the smell was horrible. And I'm like, that's it. I'm not going to become a pastor. That's it. I'm going to get kicked out of the seminary because my son pooped on the seminary president's wife. And we're like, oh my gosh, Ruth Ann, we are so sorry. And she was like, what? I raised boys. I had babies. It's no big deal. Now, what do you think she did with her clothes? Yeah. Do you think at this wonderful thing that she maybe just got like a wet wipe and just like, this is going to be important, but this is the word that is used, that it's filthy clothes. It's used either of diarrhea or vomit. Not to be gross, but that's what the word is. Now, there's another word that's used in another place where it says our righteous deeds are like filthy rags. Now, that one's a different word because the filthy rags have to do with menstruation. So a used tampon. Again, I'm sorry, that's disgusting and it's gross. You're like, I'm never going to come to church again. I don't blame you. The guy doesn't know how to dress. He's got crap all over his shirt. This is distracting me. And he's talking about menstrual rags. That's what we got to remember, is that's who we are. That's how we live. And again, you could try to hide it. You could try to cover it up. You try to get the little wet wipes. Like, I feel bad. Now, it's funny because some people are like, you just ruined a perfectly good shirt. No, if you want to, like, look at my shirt, like, especially up here, I get these stains around my neck. Right? Because I sweat like a pig and it's disgusting. And we take them to the cleaners and the cleaners are like, what do you, that's disgusting and gross. You can't do anything. And I try to hide. So don't worry. I didn't ruin a perfectly good shirt. I'm going to throw this away afterwards though, because I don't think I can. Do you think you could clean this out? Definitely. Probably not. Yeah. So that's verse 3. Joshua was dressed in filthy clothes as he stood before the angel. That's you and me. Doesn't matter how good you are. Without Jesus, our lives are filthy. They're disgusting and they're gross. Verse 4, this is important. The angel said to those who are standing before him, take off his filthy clothes. Then he said to Joshua, see, I have taken away your sin, and I will put rich garments on you. Now, it's really fun when I get to do some studies on some of these words because it was pointed out that a lot of the language that's here is all around the Day of Atonement, the Yom Kippur, which is the one day that the high priest gets to go into the Holy of Holies and make atonement for the sin. And atonement, I mean, it's always tough. What do these words mean and how do they operate? And the idea behind it is it's almost like a covering, right? So you're going to cover over the sin. But it's weird that that would be the imagery, especially in the Old Testament, because now something new is about to happen. Everything about this is very much connected to the Day of Atonement except for one phrase. And that was the phrase, I'm going to take away your sin. Totally different word. And that idea is, I'm not going to cover things up anymore. It's not something that you're going to have to keep doing over and over and over again. You don't have to keep offering offerings on the altar to the high priest. He says, there's going to be a day coming. I'm going to actually take away your sin. And he starts off by helping the priest understand this, helping Zechariah, who obviously then is going to take this to them. And that's why verse 5, then I said, put a clean turban on his head. And these are clothes that were all, again, around the Day of Atonement. That's how we know this. So they put a clean turban on his head and clothed him while the angel of the Lord stood by. The angel of the Lord gave this charge to Joshua. This is what the Lord Almighty says. If you walk in my ways and keep my requirements, then you will govern my house and have charge of my courts, and I will give you a place among those standing there. This is really important because, again, we often, my indictment that I usually have against the Lutheran church is that oftentimes we focus on the fact that we have our stained and dirty clothes, and then God takes off the dirty clothes and gives us new clean clothes, and then we all just sit there and admire everyone else's clean clothes. Well, those are great clean clothes you're wearing. Oh, you are saved. Oh, that's so wonderful. That's one. That's great. Oh, how long you've been a Lutheran? Oh, my whole life. Yeah, that's great. Oh, that's wonderful. And we get to then, like, what's the next thing? Is there life after salvation? The answer is, yeah, God has called you to something good. He has a purpose for you. And that purpose is to do good works. And I love it. I think it was R.C. Sproul. I can't remember who actually said it, but it's a great famous quote. It says, God does not need your good works, but your neighbor does. God isn't going, gosh, I really wish they would, you know, give this to me. No, he wants us to be living our lives in love towards everyone else around us. And now that's the charge. We keep the requirements. We walk in God's way. We are living a life worthy of the gospel. And this is all throughout the New Testament as well. You know that. Ephesians 2, 8, and 9 is by grace you've been saved through faith. This is a gift of God, not by works so that no one can boast. Because we are God's workmanship created in Christ Jesus to look at each other and admire each other's clothes. Now, in order to do good works, Jesus says, may your light shine before others so that they may see your good works and applaud what a great Christian you are. No. So they may see your good works and glorify God in heaven. I think too many times we sit around and just revel in our nice clothes, but now it's time to get back out and start doing things. And Joshua's going to be the leader of this. He's going to help them understand this more. And then he keeps going, verse 8, listen, O high priest, Joshua and your associates seated before you, who are men symbolic of things to come, I am going to bring my servant the branch. So there's another branch coming. So we are like sticks in the fire that have been mostly charred and burned and falling apart. But there's going to be someone else that comes, and he's going to be a branch. He's going to look good. He's going to do things right. He's going to be strong and steady. He's not going to be flaky like us. He's going to do things in a much different way. The branch is coming. And then he says, see the stone. This is the weird one. So Joshua, I do need a picture of this. I think this would be really cool. See the stone I have set in front of Joshua. There are seven eyes on that one stone. And yeah. Do you have that? I would love to see an engagement ring with a stone with seven eyes on it somehow. Now, of course, you have a little text note on that. What else could it be? Seven facets, yeah, it could be. It might be something else, but this is a vision, and this is supposed to be saying something. And so I do believe it's seven eyes again. I don't know how that looks. That's really weird. I don't know if they blink all at the same time. That would be really creepy. But these are and what is eyes obviously representing? It's talking about wisdom and seeing stuff, and seven, the number of perfection, godly number. So God is saying that I see things perfectly, I know things perfectly, and this is how you're going to be led, not by your own thoughts, not by your own filth, not by your own actions, but by what God has done in this branch that is coming. And I will grave an inscription on it, says the Lord Almighty, and I will remove the sin of this land in a single day. One day. God is not going to cover over the sin. like he's been doing through Yom Kippur and through all those other wonderful festivals. He is going to do it in one day where he's going to remove it and he is going to take it away and he is going to dress us in different clothes. That one day was Easter Sunday, when Jesus conquered sin and all of its problems, when he conquered death by dying, and he conquered the power of the devil, not through some eloquent speech, but through his power of being raised from the dead. In one day, all your sin has been removed. So that's the reason why we can say things like we say with Luther. We can say, yeah, Satan, you got me. I'm not that good. I have lots of problems. I'm a filthy, nasty sinner. And you even missed a few sins. But guess what? I've been saved by God. And you've got to learn what it means to have holy earplugs, to stop the noise of the accuser telling you how bad you are and the noise of your own heart that says just how imperfect you are, and instead hear the words of God, of Jesus. You are forgiven, you are loved, you are mine. There's the New Testament imagery that I love so much because it talks about when we're baptized, when we are brought into the kingdom of God. It says that we are clothed with Christ. Now, that's a great imagery. It's hard for me to really fully imagine it. But if Jesus were a garment, it would be as you putting on the garment. So now then, when God looks at you, he doesn't say, oh, Mark, sinner, disgusting, gross. A lot of people think that I'm going to get to heaven and God's going to pull out like a little Rolodex and be like flipping through the stuff like, ooh, these are a lot of sins. No, he's going to get up to heaven. He's going to look at me. I'm going to get up to heaven. He's going to look at me and go, ooh, but who is that? Jesus Christ, my dearly beloved son, the Lamb of God that has taken away the sin of all the world, my perfect sacrificial son. Come into heaven and all that awaits. That's what's going to happen, and it's incredible. Again, let's not stare at each other's clothes, because there's one more thing. It does get used. I didn't really look it up again, but I'm pretty sure I heard it in a Hamilton song. I think so. So if you know Hamilton really well, it's the George Washington speech. That he's served his presidency. He's ready to go. And then he does this one line, and I remember hearing that. I'm like, yeah, that's from the Bible, but I had a hard time remembering exactly where, and then I read this, and I'm like, oh, here it is. Verse 10, in that day, each of you will invite his neighbor to sit under his vine and fig tree, declares the Lord Almighty. It's no longer my job alone. I love it. The pressure's off. Whose job is it to share God's love to the world? All of us. It's not just the priest. It's not just that person that controls everything. We are all now free to go and share with others. And when we live under God's grace and mercy, we will have a prosperity, not in monetary things, but in the richness of the love and grace that he's given to us so that we can share with every other person. And every single one of you has a story. Every single one of you has a fig tree. Every one of you has a vine where you can say, this is what God has done for me. And watch what he does with that. It fits perfect. I don't think I've ever used this in a sermon, and so I thought it fits perfectly. It's going to show how old I am. You that are a little bit older will know this story. It's a guy by the name of Walt Wangren. He wrote a bunch of stories, and one of the stories that he wrote was called The Ragman. Who's heard of The Ragman? Oh, wow. Only a few of you. This is fantastic. I remember hearing this, and it put into story form the message of Jesus Christ and what he did so beautifully. I saw a strange sight. I stumbled upon a story most strange, like nothing in my life, my street sense, my sly tongue had ever prepared me for. Hush now, and I will tell it to you. Even before the dawn, one Friday morning, I noticed a young man, handsome and strong, walking the alleys of our city. He was pulling an old cart filled with clothes, both bright and new. And he was calling in a clear tenor voice, "Rags! Rags! New rags for old. I will take your old, dirty, and tired rags. Rags!" His arms were like. Now, this is a wonder, I thought to myself, for the man stood 6'4", and his arms were like tree limbs, hard and muscular. I had no better job than this. To be a rashed love and wonderment. Could he find no better job than this? To be a rag man in the inner city. I followed him. My curiosity drove me, and I wasn't disappointed, for what I was about to see was miraculous. Soon the rag man saw a woman standing on her back porch. She was sitting in tears, sobbing into a handkerchief, sighing and shedding 1,000 tears, her knees and elbows made a sad X. Her shoulders shook, her heart was breaking. The ragman stopped his cart, and quietly he walked to the woman, stepping around tin cans, dead toys, and dead diapers. "Give me your rag," he said gently, "and I'll give you another." He slipped the handkerchief from her eyes. She looked up and he laid across her palm a linen cloth so clean that it shined. She blinked from the gift to the giver. Then as he began to pull his cart again, the ragman did a strange thing. He put her stained handkerchief to his own face and he began to weep, to sob as grievously as she had done. His shoulders were shaking vigorously, yet she was left without a tear. "This is a wonder," I breathed to myself, and I followed the sobbing ragman like a child who cannot turn away from a mystery. "Rags! Rags! New rags for old." In a little while, when the sky showed gray behind the rooftops and I could see the shredded curtains hanging out black windows, the ragman came upon a girl whose head was wrapped in a bandage, whose eyes were empty. Blood soaked her bandage. A single line of blood ran down her cheek. Now the ragman, full of compassion, looked upon this child with pity as he drew a lovely yellow bonnet from his cart. "Give me your rag, and I'll give you mine." The child could only gaze at him while he loosened the bandage, removed it, and tied it to his own head while placing the bonnet upon her. I gasped at what I saw, for with the bandage went the wound. Against his brow it ran a darker, more substantial blood. It was his own. "Rags, rags, I take old rags," cried the sobbing, bleeding, strong ragman. The sun hurt both the sky now and my eyes. The ragman seemed more and more in a hurry. "Are you going to work?" he asked a young man who leaned against a telephone pole. The man shook his head. The ragman pressed him, "Do you have a job?" "Are you crazy?" sneered the man. He pulled away from the pole, revealing the right sleeve of his jacket, flat, the cuff tucked into his pocket. He had no arm. "So," said the ragman, "give me your jacket, and I'll give you mine." The one-armed man took off his jacket, as did the ragman, and I trembled at what I was now seeing. The ragman's arm stayed in its sleeve. And when the other put the ragman's jacket on, he now had two good arms, thick as tree limbs. "Go to work," said the now one-armed ragman. Stumbling upon a drunk, the ragman found lying unconscious beneath an army blanket, an old man hunched in a fetal position. He took that blanket and wrapped it around himself, but for the drunk, he left new clothes. And now I had to run to keep up with the ragman, though he was weeping uncontrollably and bleeding freely at the forehead, pulling his cart with one arm, stumbling for drunkenness, falling again and again, exhausted, looking older and sick, yet he moved with a steady pace. He eventually came to the city limits and then rushed beyond. I wept to see the change in this man. I hurt to see his sorrow, and yet I needed to see where he was going in such haste, perhaps to know what drove him onward. The ragman came to a landfill, the garbage pits. I wanted to help in what he was attempting to do, but I hung back, hiding. He climbed a hill. With tormented labor, he cleared a little space on that hill. Then he laid down and pillowed his head on a handkerchief and a jacket. He covered his bones with an army blanket, and then he died. How I cried to witness that death. I slumped over and wailed as one who has no hope. I had come to admire the ragman. I sobbed myself to sleep. I did not know. How could I know? I slept through Friday night and Saturday night too. But then on Sunday morning, I was wakened by a violently supernatural bright light. Light, pure, bright, demanding light slammed against my face. I blinked and I looked and I saw the ragman folding his blanket most carefully, a scar on his forehead, but alive. There was no sign of sorrow or age, and all the rags he had gathered shined, cleansed, and bright. I walked up to the ragman. I told him my name. I felt compelled to remove my clothes. I said to him with longing in my voice, "Dress me." He dressed me. My Lord, he put new rags on me, and I am a wonder beside him. The ragman, the Christ.